May it please the court, my name is Paul Dalton. I represent Mr. and Mrs. Jepson and their daughter, MJ. I appreciate this court taking its time to hear our oral arguments in this case. This case is not as simple as the government's brief would indicate. It is not a single-issue case. The reason it's not a single-issue case is because I don't believe the government's position is correct with regard to the application of the Buchanan decision. It is also not correct because the government was the one that protracted this litigation. And it's a pattern that is evident from the very beginnings of this case. The government actually placed our client's child at the River School in 2000. By the time 2004 came along, they had started to develop some programs which they should have had in place from the very beginning, i.e. back in 2000 and even prior to that. But when they attempted to remove the child, our client filed a due process hearing and the government settled. That was back in 04, in November. In March, they made a second attempt to remove the child, and that is the decision that was appealed by the government after we prevailed at the due process hearing. Now, that's very significant, because this is not a situation where the government voluntarily did something that changed whatever it was that the party in a particular case was trying to achieve through their lawsuit. If you look at Beethoven, if you look at Lewis Continental Bank, those are all cases in line with Buchanan and are properly cited and relied on by the government. But if you look at Select Milk Producers, a case before this court, decided by this court just 2 years ago, you'll see that they admit that even though there was a mootness in that case, that the plaintiff was awarded attorney fees. And I think what's crucial in Select Milk Producers is that there was something of substance that the plaintiffs achieved, even though it was only a preliminary injunction. If you remember that case, it was a situation where the Secretary of Agriculture had two different prices for butterfat. One, which for butterfat that was made into cheese, and one which was made into just buttermilk. After the preliminary injunction, And that became important because the price was going to be retroactively applied, and the plaintiffs in that case, the milk producers, were going to lose $5 million. They saved that money, even though subsequent to that time of the preliminary injunction, the government, through the Secretary of Agriculture, changed their mind and brought the prices together. So then the case was moot, and both parties said it was moot, but yet they still were the prevailing party under Buchanan. Well, we went to a due process hearing, and we had a settlement on the record that was incorporated into that administrative law judge's decision. This is not a situation like Buchanan. This is not a situation where the West Virginia legislature or any outside party decided voluntarily to change what we were arguing for our client. The district appealed this case to the district court because they did not want to pay that tuition at the River School for 04 and 05. When the third case came up in January 06 and they settled that for the 05-06 case, that is when this decision of the previous due process hearing back in 05 became moot, because we're talking about the previous tuition in 04 and 05. Now we're talking about, in the third case, the tuition in 05-06. So that mooted the 04-05. The hearing officer said to the government attorney, you should withdraw your case in federal court because this issue is now moot. They didn't do that. In fact, the cost for our client doubled from that time through a series of pleadings, from the fact that we filed our motion for summary judgment. They filed their motion for summary judgment. We filed, our motion was denied. We filed for reconsideration. They opposed. The four or five different pleadings after this case of when they settled the 05, 06 due process hearing. Now, the government says that this case is precisely, and our arguments are precisely on point with Buchanan. That is absolutely not the case. The government tried over and over again not to pay this tuition, and they lost every single time. And then when they lost every single time, they appealed. When they lost again, by presenting evidence at a hearing and then deciding their evidence couldn't meet their burden of proof, they refused to back down. So it is more than just the simple case of there being a mootness. Yes, there was a mootness, but it is more akin to Select Milk than it is akin to Lewis Continental or Beethoven. What we're asking this court to do is award attorney fees on a number of reasons. If you disagree with me that this case is like Buchanan, which I would really hope would not be the case, because I think that your prior decision in Select Milk Products was a very good decision because it pointed out that the critical factor that distinguished that case from Buchanan was there was actually something done before a judicial officer. Whereas Buchanan and Beethoven and Lewis Continental Bank are all situations where some outside authority. In Lewis, it was the Florida Department of Banking that changed the rules to let outside non-residents have banking privileges. But here we have an administrative law judge that says this case is being settled because the government doesn't believe they can meet their burden of proof, and he incorporates that in his hearing determination, which is a judgment because this court has said if you have a right to appeal, it is a judgment, and you said that in Select Milk Products. So what we have is a situation where when we get to the federal district court, when they've appealed that, what they're looking for is not to pay this tuition. When Judge Leon dismissed their appeal by granting our motion, he irreversibly set in motion the fact that that tuition could not be recovered or reversed. Now, he said it shouldn't be recovered because of the state put provision. But in reality, the way I think this case should be analyzed from the point of Buchanan is the fact that here we have something that was actually adjudicated. Evidence was presented. The parties settled the case. The hearing officer incorporated it in his decision, and that decision was appealed. It is very much unlike the situation of the other cases like Buchanan. And therefore, on at least two grounds, we're asking for our attorney fees. One is the fact that this case is akin to Select Milk Producers and we're entitled. The other is the only reason that attorney fees were multiplied was the continual refusal by the District of Columbia to moot the case on their own, even after being advised by the hearing officer. If there are no questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Mary Connolly on behalf of the District of Columbia appellees. First, I'd like to just respond to Mr. Dalton's argument that Select Milk supports their argument that they're entitled to attorney's fees. As the court is aware, in Select Milk, there was court-ordered relief on the merits. A preliminary injunction was issued by the court that gave the plaintiffs their substantial merits-based relief. And Select Milk does not support the plaintiff's request for fees here because there was no relief that was ordered by the court. In addition, just to clarify.
As I understand the argument, though, you have to look at it from the perspective of the district is the plaintiff here. So what happens to the defendant? And the defendant says, I won, I won, I won. And that, in effect, is what relief was granted by the district court. Now, I know your argument is it's no adjudication on the merits.
That's correct. Well, this court has not addressed whether Buchanan applies to prevailing defendants where there's been a dismissal. However, the Second Circuit has addressed that in two cases and has held that where a statute permits recovery by either by a prevailing party, whether that's a defendant or a plaintiff, that the prevailing party requirements apply to both plaintiffs and defendants, and that therefore, whether it's a whether it's the defendant that seeks, whether there's been a whether it's the plaintiff or defendant, it's not enough that there's been a dismissal. That's not enough to entitle a defendant to attorney's fees. There has to be an adjudication on the merits or a court-ordered consent decree.
What about the Seventh Circuit?
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Seventh Circuit.
The Seventh Circuit in Nathan.
Is that what it's called? No, Steel Company. I don't know what the other party's name is. Steel Company is one of them. Steel, it's a case at 230 Fed 3rd, 923, year 2000. Familiar with it?
I'm not familiar with that.
A motion seeking an award under any of these rules of statute is a case or controversy that may be adjudicated to the extent the movement has suffered at its adversary's hands an injury may be redressed by a decision in its favor. This is an unusual situation, as you've said, where, as Judge Rogers has said, where the defendant is the prevailing party seeking attorney's fees, prevailing on jurisdictional ground, but prevailing nonetheless. And the Second Circuit has, just as you've said, rejected that claim. The Seventh Circuit has embraced it. There is a circuit split out there. Are you unaware of that?
I'm sorry. I'm not aware of that. I'm just aware of the Second Circuit decisions.
Well, the Second
on
Circuit
that.
Decision is conclusory, as far as I can tell. The Seventh Circuit decision bears some reading, some study. It seems to me that every case that you've got is a case in which the plaintiffs are, except the New York case, is the Second Circuit case, is a case where the plaintiffs are the moving parties.
That's correct, but
now in Buchanan, at one point the court says a party. Later on, when it's summing up, it says a plaintiff. But that was a plaintiff case, so it's understandable that it would say that. It didn't say anything that precludes a defendant.
There's nothing in Buchanan that precludes. I think Buchanan applies to both plaintiffs and defendants, of course. However, the same logic applies to prevailing plaintiffs and prevailing defendants, and that is that there has to be an adjudication on the merits and
well,
a dismissal
but
for lack.
Why does there have to be an adjudication on the merits? There has to be a change in the legal relationship, right?
That's the.
If one can be accomplished without an adjudication on the merits, then that should satisfy the standard. Should
it? I don't think that Buchanan can be read that way, and I don't think that the decisions of this circuit that apply Buchanan can be read to provide that a party prevails absent a determination that has been made on the merits.
Can the district come back to these parents and relitigate this?
It cannot relitigate the issue of the placement for that particular year.
Right.
And that's because the district did not appeal the determination that the case was moot.
So the result of this jurisdictional determination is going to preclude the district from ever getting the relief it was seeking.
I'm not sure whether right. or not the district could seek reimbursement in superior court, but the basis
well,
for
wouldn't it be estopped against these parents?
That it could be estopped
so
against.
So this case is over. Whether you call it jurisdiction or the merits, and that's another matter, as to whether it's properly labeled jurisdiction. But assuming it is, either way. The functional equivalent. The district cannot get this money and will never be able to get this money for this school year from these parents.
And the reason why the district cannot get the money, the court determined, the reason why the district cannot get the money is because the court has dismissed this case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, and we chose not to appeal that. And there have been...
Had you appealed it and lost, the parents would be prevailing parties?
Had we prevailed that?
No, no. Had you appealed the matter and lost, would the parents then be prevailing on the merits? Would the parents then be prevailing parties?
If we lost on the mootness, if we lost on mootness, that would be a determination, an affirmation by this.
So you could carry this up to the Court of Appeals and cause them to incur further attorney's fees, and still they would not, and when you lose, they don't prevail.
Because because a dismissal for mootness is a dismissal on jurisdictional grounds.
That is a true and incontrovertible statement, but it's utterly irrelevant. The question is whether there's been a change in the legal relationship between the parties by virtue of the judgment entered by the district court.
Right, and in addition to that, if I could just complete that, as the Supreme Court said in Soul versus Minor, there has to be a change in the manner in which Congress intended in fee-shifting statutes. And as the court has said in Buckner, that means in the manner in which Congress intended that there be an adjudication on the merits and a determination that the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, as a Supreme Court held in the Lewis case, which I cite in my brief, that was in the 1988 context, that is not an adjudication on the merits. It's a determination that the court lacks jurisdiction to determine the merits.
Where's the Buckner case, sorry?
The Lewis case that we cite.
You said Buckner a moment ago.
I meant Buchanan. Buchanan. In Soul versus Weiner, the Supreme Court held this year that the change in the legal relationship has to be a change in the manner in which Congress intended in the fee-shifting statutes. Because the...
Is that a plaintiff situation, though?
Soul was a plaintiff situation.
In other words, for the government to win on its Buchanan argument, doesn't it have to argue that what the Supreme Court was getting at in the case was a theory that you can win, but you haven't won as a result of something that you won in court? The other party may have changed its position.
The catalyst.
Thank you.
Yes.
That's what the court was getting at. But does that theory have any relevance here where you have a defendant in the posture of the parents? That's the real question for me.
Yes, and I think that the answer under Buchanan, under the Lewis case, the Supreme Court decision, under the Mosley case, which is a Tenth Circuit decision, the Second Circuit decision in WG, and decisions holding that a dismissal for mootness is a jurisdictional dismissal that deprives the court of authority to award attorney's fees. Under those cases, that logic applies equally where it's the a case is dismissed and it's a defendant that seeks fees or it's a plaintiff who seeks fees.
Because we take into account that if we agree with you, then it creates a disincentive for a parent who loses to appeal?
Under this court's decision in Edmonds, yeah, that would be a policy consideration that cannot be relevant, yeah, to a determination of prevailing party status.
Ms. Connelly, it seems to me that there are only three cases that are relevant here, because there are three cases that involve defendants other than this case. Two in the Second Circuit, Lou is the leading case.
Sloan and the Dattner decision.
Dattner for sure. Dattner and one other. Okay, Sloan. And the other in the Seventh Circuit, which goes the other way. And all post-Buchanan. Here's the Seventh Circuit. We hold that when a dismissal for want of jurisdiction forecloses the plaintiff's claim, the defendant is the prevailing party. Now, ordinarily, a dismissal for want of jurisdiction doesn't do that.
Correct.
But when it does, according to the Seventh Circuit, the defendant is the prevailing party. The Second Circuit doesn't grapple with this at all. So what is your, how would you succinctly answer just that statement by the Seventh Circuit? If it forecloses the plaintiff's claim, then the defendant is the prevailing party.
My response to that, Your Honor, is that a determination that a dismissal on jurisdictional grounds is a determination that's made before a court reaches the merits. And the court must always...
It's all true, but it's also superficial. Forget all that at that level. Go underneath that to what's going on between the parties. If the claim is foreclosed, the Seventh Circuit says, the defendant has prevailed. The plaintiff's claim is right. Over, out, can't be heard from, will never recover on that.
Right, but you have to look at
but
why...
But the other side hasn't prevailed. This side's lost, but the other side hasn't prevailed.
But the court has to look at why the claim is dismissed. It's not enough that it's dismissed
exactly,
and it's foreclosed.
Right. Because if it's dismissed in a way that just simply puts it in another court or another day or for an amendment that can easily be accomplished in the complaint, then clearly the defendant has not prevailed.
Right, or jurisdiction. Jurisdiction
all those
is,
are jurisdictional, what I was
right.
just saying.
A lack of subject matter jurisdiction is jurisdictional, and a dismissal from mootness is a determination that the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, and that is not a merits-based determination. It doesn't satisfy Buchanan. Buchanan applies equally to plaintiffs
Can
and defendants.
Can it come back? Can the claim come back?
Because the district, I don't believe that the claim can come back.
That's right.
True of other cases in which there has been dismissals for mootness. It's true of every case where a case is dismissed for mootness. It can't
come back.
I'm sorry?
Typically, a case dismissed for mootness can come back, you're saying?
It cannot come back.
Cannot, okay.
Because one of the parties has, if a case is dismissed because a party took voluntary action that renders the case moot, the case is over.
It doesn't have to be voluntary. Case
right.
can be moot. Suppose the child in question in one of these IDEA cases is objecting to the placement or the program, and then the child's disability is such that she can't attend school that year after all. The case is moot, right?
Right. That's correct.
Not because of any voluntary action.
Yeah, I just...
And it might become unmoot if that medical condition changes in a few months.
Perhaps for that for that year.
That'd be very unusual.
If the student graduates, then the case
then
is moot.
Then it's moot for good.
It's moot. And whether it's moot for good or it could come back, the fact is that determination of mootness is a determination that the court lacks jurisdiction. That's a determination that's made before the court reaches the merits. It's not a merits-based determination.
That's all true. We've been over that. Okay.
Okay.
I do have one question, which is you've argued this case clearly as just being moot, but why doesn't the fact that the government here was seeking monetary award avoid the whole mootness issue?
Tuition reimbursement?
Right.
Well, the district court found that the district was not entitled to tuition reimbursement. We argued that that we were entitled to tuition reimbursement, and then in addition, that even if we were not entitled to tuition reimbursement, that the case was capable of repetition yet evading review, so that it was not moot for that reason as well. As to the tuition reimbursement argument, there is a case in this court, it's the Jenkins versus Squillicote case, in which this court held that where a parent prevails at an administrative hearing, that and then seeks tuition reimbursement, that where the parent prevails at the administrative hearing and then the school files a complaint challenging that tuition reimbursement is not available as a remedy under IDEA. So we're not arguing on appeal that we're not actually challenging the mootness determination. However, there was a separate argument that was made that this case was capable of repetition yet evading review because one-year placement decisions are, by their nature, capable of repetition yet evading review. And there are a number of decisions, including in the Jenkins case, that support that determination.
Thank you, Ms. Connelly.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The reference to the Soul case is a situation where the court described the situation of the settlement as a private agreement. We don't have a private agreement in our case. We have a case that went to trial, witnesses and evidence was taken, and then the government decided to they couldn't meet its burden and settled. With regard to the questions raised by the court as to the issue of the Seventh Circuit decision, I believe, even though I didn't find that case either, that case is directly on point. The other thing is that, I just want to close with this, that in milk producers, that statute does not require you to exhaust your administrative remedies. IDEA does. That's why this matter wasn't heard directly before Judge Leon to begin with. But if you take the differences between the two statutes, you have exactly the same case, in our opinion. And therefore, you should have exactly the same results. This court said there that the parties were the prevailing party, the plaintiffs were the prevailing parties, and then I believe that in this case, our clients should be determined to be the prevailing parties. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ms. Connolly, thank you, too. This case is submitted.